we didn't just lose Jennifer. She was taken from us.
Prosecutors say Sean Finnegan and Rebecca Dishman kidnapped, raped, and murdered 36-year-old Jennifer Paxton.
It's a gruesome case, but it's important for people to know that this does happen. It can happen in your backyard.
I just thought his eyes were so dead. There was nothing, no remorse.
We, the jury, unanimously find the punishment for defendant Sean Shannon Finnegan shall be death.
A Knoxville woman with a history of homelessness and addiction thought she had found a safe haven when Sean Finnegan and his girlfriend, Rebecca Dishman, opened up their Oak Ridge home to her. It turned out to be anything but. 8 months later, investigators found Jennifer Paxton's body underneath a bed in that apartment. Investigators would soon realize that she had been tortured, killed, and her body placed in a freezer. In this episode of Behind the Headline, we look back into the investigation into Jennifer Paxton's death, how detectives built their case and pinned it on those two suspects. We will hear how it all unfolded through two of the journalists who covered the trial extensively. But we begin where it all started. Former 10 News reporter Vinay Simlot takes us to that Oak Ridge apartment.
At an apartment on Fairview Road, prosecutors say Sean Finnegan and Rebecca Dishman kidnapped, raped, and murdered 36-year-old Jennifer Paxton. Authorities say she was homeless. The medical examiner says Paxton died of strangulation and her death was a homicide. That report says a friend took Dishman to Campbell County. She told the friend she and Finnegan had a body in their freezer. Officers then found the body underneath a bed, feet away from a, quote, large upright freezer with frozen pizzas and frozen burritos. The autopsy report says they found signs of slicing injuries on Jennifer Paxton's body after she died. The report says someone removed most of her ear, her nose, and her arm.
It isn't asked for very often in East Tennessee and usually is reserved for particularly heinous crimes.
Now, Anderson County Attorney General Dave Clark is asking for the death penalty. His office says both Finnegan and Dishman qualify for it because the murder was especially heinous and it involved torture or serious physical abuse. Knoxville Attorney T. Scott Jones says a death penalty case is more complicated.
It is one of the most pressure-packed both for the prosecution and for defense counsel.
Anyone tried with the death penalty gets two lawyers and opportunities for appeal at the state and federal level.
What you're trying to do is to mitigate against the death penalty, that is to engender sympathy from the jury.
Joining me now are two of the reporters who covered this case extensively, multi-skilled journalist Ellis Rold and WBIR chief investigative producer and reporter John North. Thank you both for being here. Both of you are coming to this story from two different perspectives. Ellis, you're a relatively new reporter, and this had to be something. John, you are a seasoned reporter. You've covered many, many gruesome cases like this one.
Yeah, and every time one is about to come up for trial, I sort of wonder what are we about to go through? Because, you know, we had heard hints, and you saw Vinay's story, there were clear suggestions that really awful things had been done to Jennifer Paxton. And, you know, most of the time these days, DAs don't play around when it comes to the death penalty. If they're going to seek it, it's the worst of the worst, and that's exactly what this turned out to be.
Yeah, they sought the death penalty, and we'll let you know where it landed. Ellis, you've been in the business now a couple of years. Mm-hmm. Was this the first case that you covered to this extreme?
Yes. First court case trial, actually, that I had covered
ever,
start to finish ever, was this one. And I remember John telling me, okay, you're going to go. You need to prepare yourself for what you are going to hear in testimony because of the gruesome details that were in this case. And I learned a lot. I learned a lot about, you know, how to handle those details. It is challenging, but it was definitely a very interesting and grim case.
That's the beauty of working with veteran reporters. They will guide you through the process. All right, let's go ahead and dig in. And before we get to the trial, let's talk about the people who were the key people in this case. We're talking Sean Finnegan, Rebecca Dishman, and Jennifer Paxton. Let's dig into their lives as much as we know that we garnered from this case.
We should start with Finnegan because he is the center of all of it. I'll just say briefly, and Ellis can jump in. Finnegan was a box of dynamite, probably waiting to go off. He had had, it's charitable to say, a difficult childhood. Probably most of his life had been difficult, warped, twisted. When he'd been younger, his older brother had murdered a neighbor down in Florida, which we can talk about later. But it's very clear, we know now, that Sean Finnegan was a deeply disturbed man, and sex was a part of that disturbance. As you mentioned, Robin, they kidnapped and held Jennifer Paxton in late 2019, but some years before, he had tried to do something similar to a woman. And so that was kind of a warning sign of what I think you can argue was to come. But he was a man who felt comfortable with violence. He engaged in twisted behavior that just you would say, that's not normal, that's beyond the bounds. And he also was smart enough to figure out how to prey on people, including Dishman. He used her. She was agreeable to it, but wouldn't you say? I mean, she was like 30 years younger than he was. She has her own culpability, but she also was open to suggestion, if you will.
Yes, and it was interesting to kind of hear about that dynamic, and it's something that Finnegan's defense team really honed in on to try to get any responsibility put onto Dishman and off of him. But she was in her 20s, he was in his 50s, and neighbors testified, you know, she was childlike. She was interested in things that kids were interested in. She wore kids' clothing. So there was an argument about, you know, her mental state, and I think it kind of plays into how she was able to be preyed upon by Finnegan.
She had a bad childhood. I think she'd been kind of passed around. I think I remember reading she had like three fiancés at some point. Well, you're in your early 20s and you got three fiancés or maybe more than that. So she was, for him, I think an excellent accomplice.
And also it seemed like, and again, she had her own culpability, but also it appeared to be a victim herself when it came to Finnegan.
Let's talk about Jennifer Paxton. First off, how did their worlds collide? How did they meet? Do we know that?
So Paxton, she had struggled with drugs. She had been intermittently homeless. Her family was there for the entire trial. She had a family. She had people that cared about her.
She had children.
She had children that supported her. But as many people who have family members who struggle with addiction know, oftentimes when they are in the throes of that, they don't want help and they don't want to get clean or be around people that they know they have this issue. So she was homeless and she would talk to her family every now and again. They would try to go find her or visit her, give her food, things like that. But Sean Finnegan was working at the Pint House as a cook overnight. And Paxton had kind of been hanging around there, and that's how he met her, found her, and eventually kidnapped her.
In the lead up to the trial, was there much interaction with police, investigators, leading up to gather all this information? Or clearly did a lot of this come from when you were in the midst of the trial, learning their background?
My recollection is we had enough to realize that this was going to be a truly horrible case.
Right.
The way it was initially presented to the public, Dishman and Finnegan were like this, right? There, we didn't have more than two-dimensional perceptions of their relationship or their role. So far as we knew, they were both in it together. We knew enough, you know, we knew about torture. We knew about a freezer. We knew about a body. So that makes you go, oh, my goodness. But the finer details of the horror, we did not know, and that would come out. Vinay ran the package about, for example, ultimately, how Sean Finnegan abused Jennifer Paxton's body. A lot of that stuff wouldn't come out until trial.
Well, and we'll get into it certainly as we're talking more about the trial, which then started in August of 2024. This was years after the crime. Finnegan stood trial for Jennifer Paxton. 10 News reporter Sam Perez was there for the first day of testimony. Let's take a look.
Investigators say the couple lured 35-year-old Jennifer Paxton into their home in 2019. An Oak Ridge police warrant says, quote, once at the home, the victim was held against her will, physically attacked with a baseball bat, tortured, raped, deprived of food and medical care, strangled, and then left for dead. Investigators say at this home on Fairview Road, she was chained to the bed and shackled with a dog collar. The warrant says her body was mutilated with a sharp instrument. Police found her body in the house about 9 months after the killing. In court today, the prosecution and the defense directed questions to roughly 70 potential jurors. Starting around 9:30 a.m., the state began asking jurors if they could be, quote, stone cold decision makers when it comes to the verdict and potential punishment. The assistant district attorney general told the jury that they will hear from Dishman when she testifies against Finnegan as part of her plea deal to avoid the death penalty. The state also characterized the victim as a woman who was working as a prostitute to fund her drug addiction and asked if the jury could see her as deserving of protection. The defense began questioning around 10:45 a.m. and reminded jurors their duty is to assume Finnegan is innocent, telling the panel, quote, I have to know you can sit as jurors, not just as punishers.
So the two of you were in that courtroom from beginning to end. Let's start at the beginning. You go in. Who's there? And what is the feeling in that courtroom?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the first testimony really came from neighbors, kind of setting the scene of the layout of the apartment complex. It was kind of more so condos or townhouses, one level. And you really got the sense from neighbors that they heard a lot of arguing in Dishman and Finnegan's apartment, that they seemed to kind of have an unusual relationship. They noted the age difference, things like that. So we really kind of heard from neighbors who set the scene and who would eventually be directly involved in reporting Finnegan to police.
Okay, so you're in the courtroom. Finnegan is in the courtroom. What is his demeanor to start out?
He never really showed much emotion. I think he was just sort of tightly controlled. And, I mean, obviously we were looking at him. He would engage with his two defense attorneys, but he mostly didn't react at all. Ellis mentioned the neighbors. Another key witness early on was the state's most important witness, and that was Dishman herself. Yeah. She'd pleaded guilty, I think, in like December of the prior year. That allowed her to avoid the threat of the death penalty. She also essentially traded away her life. She's in prison forever. But she, you know, the state needed her because they could take the jury into Sean Finnegan's room in that rented part of the house where they lived in Oak Ridge. And she could talk about how Paxton was abused. Dishman took in part in some of it, or sat there passively. Mm-hmm. And that sort of, for the jury early on, could give them an idea of, pardon my language, the hell that Jennifer Paxton went through.
And you all listened to the hell. It's hard to listen to, but once again, as reporters, that's what we're tasked to do. We're the eyes, the ears of the public. The public needs to know, even though it is hard to share that information. But walk us through the hell that you all had to listen to that Jennifer Paxton endured.
So hearing from Dishman right off the bat, again, kind of showed the jury her demeanor and maybe a little insight into the dynamic between the two of them that would come up again and again during the trial, because there were a lot of moments, especially after Dishman was off the stand, that the state and the defense were really arguing over, okay, well, who took the final blow, so to speak, right? We know that both of these people were there, but they were kind of going back and forth with who really was to blame. And we know that Jennifer Paxton came home with Sean Finnegan from the Pint House. He promised her drugs, a place to stay. And at some point during that, she was struck in the head.
It appears started the process.
Yes, with a baseball bat. and taken to Sean and Rebecca's bedroom, tied up. They later found dog leashes, choke chains, metal chains, so really gruesome things that they were using to constrain her. And then we know that she was held for several days, tortured, raped repeatedly, and kind of would go in and out of consciousness during all of this.
You had mentioned morphine. Mm-hmm. They actually were providing morphine. Would that be almost to keep her alive or to keep her present, if you will, as this torture continued?
The state alluded to that. Now, heroin can break down in the body and appear as morphine. There was a really high level of that present that they found after the autopsy. So that was another point of contention between the state and the defense. Was it heroin that had broken down, or was it that they were giving her morphine to keep her alive? And I believe, John, correct me if I'm wrong, that Sean Finnegan's mother, who actually lived with them during this entire time,
lived in the apartment.
In the apartment, and she had an interesting kind of role or presence in all of this and her relationship with Dishman.
She was living in the home.
Yeah.
We don't know what she knew or didn't know,
right?
Really. We just don't know.
But she, I believe, was on morphine. And so that was kind of
She kind of was getting end-of-life pain care. So that's why she had the drugs, and Sean knew it and took advantage of it.
Yeah.
I just want to make one point about Dishman. While in the few days that they allowed Paxton to continue to live, Sean Finnegan's still working at the restaurant as a cook. So he would go away and leave Dishman with Paxton. So, again, we will never know to our satisfaction what all Rebecca Dishman did. We're just not going to know. You can use your common sense to infer what you think may have happened, but there were times where he'd go off to the restaurant
for 12-hour shifts.
And it would be Dishman there alone with her, with the victim, until ultimately, you know, she was beaten to death or whatever and died.
Didn't she present some conflicting statements along the way in her testimony? Just based on some past stories I was looking at, we will never know.
Well, she wanted to be the victim, and yet they were in a relationship, slave-master relationship that came up.
There's definitely control.
Yeah, right. She was under control, but then also, having been sort of somebody passed around, she clung to the relationship that she had, such as it was. It was a sick relationship, but there are aspects of this relationship between her and Finnegan that you just don't even really want to talk about, you know, photographs and just behavior you don't want to talk about.
Mm-hmm. So a matter of days, this torture continued. Ultimately, what led to her death?
Ligature strangulation was what was in her autopsy as cause of death. The state pointed to a pair of shoelaces that had DNA on them. They believe that Finnegan or Dishman, it's hard to say,
She was present.
Right. Was essentially strangling Jennifer Paxton and then
bringing
her back to life, almost, or strangling her so much to the point that she would pass out but not die, and then she would wake up, strangle her again. And that's where the torture piece, of course, comes in as well. Just awful, awful testimony to listen to, especially for Paxton's family who's in the room.
And another gruesome aspect of the story, once she is dead, what they do with her body.
Yeah, well, this is how Sean Finnegan thought. He just had to come up with a sort of a utilitarian way to deal with the body, and it adds to the horrific nature of this. His solution was to go get a freezer.
So he went and bought a freezer or got it from somewhere?
A few days before,
before
she died, actually.
Okay.
He acquired a freezer and kept it in a closet at the foot of his bed, the same room where Paxton was murdered. And that's where he put her body and kept it for months.
And also, keep in mind, talking about the bedroom, Paxton stayed in that bedroom for the entirety, all four or five of those days, and Finnegan and Dishman were sleeping in that room. So at night, it's the three of them in that room. And that was something the state brought up. You know, these are people who are able to actually fall asleep while someone is in that condition.
How then, I think this is a question we all had, and it was revealed, how this months later, her body is finally discovered.
That's because of Dishman.
Yeah. So explain how that played out.
Dishman had gotten fairly close with a neighbor, the neighbors that I mentioned, and they had seen her periodically with a black eye. She would say that she was afraid of Sean. She said she wanted to use one of their phones to send Facebook messages to people because Sean wouldn't let her have a phone or would look at all of her correspondence. So Dishman eventually told one of those neighbors, you know, there's a body in my freezer. And of course, their reaction is that actually true? And that's how the cops ended up getting involved. And John, you can talk a little bit more about that as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's sort of how Dishman redeemed himself by saying, I'm in an abusive relationship, where the neighbor, you know, interpreting that for her, oh, and there's a body in the basement. So Oak Ridge police go to the house. Then wasn't there a confrontation outside the house with Finnegan?
And Sean was like, I have no idea what you're talking about.
Keep in mind, so Finnegan has this confrontation or realizes that the jig is now up.
Right.
He doesn't say that.
Mm-hmm.
He knows
he
what's
knows
in the
it.
Bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know. They've just been told. And so he has this sort of conversation outside the home with them. And the police are like, well, that's fine. We're going to go get a warrant. And what he does, we learned at trial, is he then thinks, well, I've got to clear out the freezer and I've got to clean the bedroom and the house. So that's what he does while they're getting the warrant, while they're getting ready to come back, because they're going to come back. He is desperately trying to clean everything, cleans out the freezer, puts like Red Baron pizza boxes in there, puts some like burritos in there. Now remember, this is in his bedroom.
In his bedroom.
Right, it's still in his bedroom.
Yeah, tries to make it look like, and I think there was bleach, so he makes it all clean. But still, what do you do with the body? He had her at least partly wrapped up in a black trash bag. Well, the best he could do with the time that he was given in his twisted mind was to stick her under the bed in his room.
And we heard from the police officer who was going through the home and eventually found the body.
Marvell Moore.
Right, after they get the warrant. And he described, you know, walking into this room and it's perfectly clean. And just kind of how that was interesting to him, right? Maybe in this location. And why is there a freezer in the bedroom? That's really odd. He opens it up. Okay, pizza boxes. Whatever, also interesting, and puts his hand under the bed and feels something ice cold.
Imagine you're sitting on the bed, you're thinking, you know something's not right, and you reach under the bed and you feel something cold.
Right.
He knew something was up.
Why is
before
something
he reached
cold,
down there.
Cold and there's a freezer right in front of you,
and,
right?
And that's when he realizes that's where she is.
And we should also mention, you know, the Finnegan had been mutilating her body during the months that she was in the freezer. She had several...
Oh, while she was dead.
After she was already dead. Yeah, so she was killed, placed in the freezer, but she had several sharp force injuries all over her entire body. One of her ears had been cut off. She had so many injuries that were after her death, and the medical examiner was able to walk us through, okay, which injuries happened before her death, which happened essentially during her death and after. And there were dozens after she was killed. He had been mutilating
her. He did other things too.
Yes.
And let's talk about how this impacts the autopsy process, because clearly if he felt the cold, the body was still in some stage of being frozen.
Yeah.
Did that complicate issues as far as trying to figure out when and how she was killed?
They seem to have quite a good amount of information, like I mentioned, of when the injuries happened. But the medical examiner did say, you know, they had to thaw Paxton's body to be able to perform the autopsy and keep her refrigerated because she was so frozen solid. And she also talked about, the medical examiner, the freezer was not a open from the flat mm-hmm. top. It was more of a stand-up freezer.
Okay.
So Paxton had been placed in there essentially sitting down in the fetal position almost, but sitting, you know, upright, if that makes sense.
Right.
So all of the blood in her body had pooled to kind of the bottom of her body. So it also kind of changed how they performed the autopsy, because it's just not your typical, someone is killed, they're laying flat on the ground and they're found hours after, something like that. And she was also actually, Paxton was stuck to the freezer. She had a tattoo on her arm, and there was a portion of skin that when Finnegan had taken her out, the tattoo that was stuck on the freezer matched her arm.
This is something I'm curious about. I was just thinking, was Paxton, because this was a matter of months, her going to the apartment and her body being found, was she ever reported missing?
Her family okay. realized, as Ellis said, she was kind of a rolling stone.
Right.
I mean, she would drift here and there, and she would ask for money and ask for help, and then also be searching for drugs. So they knew something was wrong. Her mother knew something was wrong, but she also had lived a lifestyle where she would just disappear sometimes.
Mm-hmm. So you're sharing all this information, me, our viewers. The jury was listening to this in real time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's what we do as reporters. We're watching the whole
yes.
thing play out, and you do want to see how is the jury reacting to the information.
Well, you're always watching the jury. You're always watching the jury. And I thought they held up pretty well, but they're human beings. And I think there are two moments where, you know, they were affected, at least that I remember. One, I'll mention one, and then you may want to mention the other, but one for sure was the freezer was brought into the courtroom. And it wasn't just brought into the courtroom, but it was presented. If you're the jury, if you're the front row of the jury, here's the
right
freezer.
Right here.
Here's yeah. the freezer.
And they
brought
opened
it in.
Yeah.
And they opened it. And that, after you've heard, your head's been filled with all of this testimony about the horrible torture that this woman experienced and what happened in the months after her body was kept in that freezer, it's kind of like, woo. Okay, and that was fascinating to watch. Some of them, I think, were a little bit taken aback. One or two, maybe, of the more sort of braver jurors kind of leaned in a little bit, but that was a moment where you're like, wow, okay. And the other one struck me was when the autopsy photos
yeah.
were shown.
Yeah, so going back to the tattoo freezer situation that I mentioned, they showed a lot of different photos that were, of course, very gruesome. Lots of slice injuries that she endured after her death. It was interesting to see, and I think goes to kind of the haste that Sean Finnegan took her body out of the freezer and put her under his bed. But there was a piece of skin left in that freezer, and they showed, you know, how the tattoo kind of perfectly matched to her arm. But those photos, you know, the jury was really, really taken aback by. I mean, all the details in this case were gruesome, but when you're seeing pictures on a giant television screen, I mean, it's a lot.
Yeah, that you're used to watching these, and even in a more sanitized version on a TV show,
right.
you're not prepared necessarily to watch it play out in real life, real time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the jury took in all the evidence, and then it was time for them to make a ruling, and they did. They convicted him, and we want to take you now to Ellis, the story you reported at the sentencing. Take a look.
We didn't just lose Jennifer. She was taken from us.
An Oak Ridge man will be put to death for the gruesome murder of Jennifer Paxton in 2019. Sean Finnegan's capital murder trial started last week. He was found guilty of kidnapping, raping, torturing, and murdering Paxton.
During the sentencing phase of the trial, the state said the torture Paxton endured warranted the death penalty.
What Jennifer Paxton endured over those 4 days, how she was chained by the neck with a padlock around her neck in a bedroom in a dank apartment with no medical attention and wondering every second what's going to become of me.
The defense asked jurors to spare his life, arguing he will already spend the rest of his life in jail.
You can think about things like pity and mercy and sentiment and sympathy. His life is effectively over, but we think that he can go on and still function.
But after nearly 6 hours of deliberation, a jury sentenced Finnegan to death.
Therefore, we, the jury, unanimously find the punishment for defendant Sean Shannon Finnegan shall be death.
Finnegan has been in custody in Anderson County since 2020. He'll now be transferred to the Tennessee Department of Correction.
And we look at that video of Sean Finnegan once the sentence is delivered. He's wide-eyed. That's just a moment in time. You were there for the duration. Were there any other emotions that he shared?
Not in the first phase of the trial. I think Ellis has mentioned, or Will, we can talk about it, in the second phase of the trial. You know, with a death penalty case, there are two phases. There's the sort of the guilt phase where, did he do it? The jury says, yes, he did. Then there's a phase two, which is, okay, now we have to determine whether there are circumstances that require death. And there are chances for both the prosecution and the defense to weigh in. The prosecution points out sort of the god-awful nature of what he did, heinous, atrocious, and cruel torture. Those are legal aspects the state needs to prove. But the defense then can come in and talk about, who is this man? Mm-hmm. Is he mentally messed up? Is that part of his problem here? What's going on with him? What is mitigating what he did?
Right. And it was interesting to hear more about his family life, and we can go into what we've learned about him even after the trial concluded. But his brother's ex-wife testified during this portion, and she had been around Sean and his siblings when Sean was younger, but at the time she was dating and then married to Sean's older brother, and this is decades ago, and talked about, you know, the abuse that he went through as a child, being... He would essentially be picked up from school, skip school, by his uncle, who would ply him with drugs and alcohol and take him, and other men would sexually abuse him and his siblings. And so all of those kids went through a lot. And, you know, clearly, because he was sentenced to death, it didn't do much for the jury, but it painted a better picture of how we got here, because he had lived a life being exposed to violence, and that really led us to this trial.
And he is not the only one in his family who committed violence.
Right. This just kind of buttresses what Ellis is saying. If you can imagine the kind of environment where somebody grows up, in February, I think, of 1985, he had a older brother. They were living in Florida in Deerfield Beach, and the older brother went to literally a next-door neighbor's house where a woman lived. Her husband was away. I think she was in her early 60s. And he went in because he wanted her valuables or her money or her purse or whatever.
Yeah.
And he stabbed her repeatedly. Now, she knew the family. The family knew her. He stabbed her repeatedly, took the purse, walked out, went back home. That's not all, though, kind of the strange, bizarre nature of this. She stumbles out of the house seeking help and goes to the Finnegan house. And it's like, he stabbed me. That brother is serving a sentence in Florida penitentiary right now. But that's just kind of what we're talking about here. But, you know, that doesn't forgive you for committing such a god-awful crime. And we've talked about this in other behind-the-headline cases. Krista Pike, horrible childhood, doesn't excuse you from torturing somebody and taking their life.
You get a glimpse at his life. Ellis, you had shared prior to with me that, and John, I'm sure you too, because this was very much a team reporting effort. But you learned more about Jennifer Paxton through her family. Talk about mm-hmm. how that relationship unfolded between family and journalist.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just met them. You know, they were in the courtroom every day. Her aunt, Paxton's mother, actually died shortly after the family found out that Paxton was murdered. And I remember Paxton's aunt telling me, you know, Paxton's death really broke her mother's heart, of course, and really she died shortly after, and she said, you know, she died of a broken heart is what she told me. But they were there, her Paxton's aunt, Paxton's cousin, they were there every day. They would step out for the autopsy photos mm-hmm. and some of the more gruesome days. But, you know, they told me we loved her. She loved us. She just had a drug problem. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people can relate to that. You know, if someone that you love has an addiction and maybe they're not present every single day, you still care about them. And what happened to her was awful. And was not any easier for them, even though she, you know, had maybe struggled with drugs and engaged in some prostitution here and there to fund her drug problem. And they really did not want that to be the focus of the trial or how she ended up there. They wanted her as a person to be known. And, you know, they said she kind of always... She had issues with men. She had a rough family life relationship with her dad, and you know that kind of led her into some addiction.
As reporters, we try to talk to as many people as we can. The investigators, if they were talking, the attorneys, the family members. In this case, the two of you were able to speak to one of the jurors who served and delivered the guilty and the death sentence. This is the story that you did with this jury. Let's take a look at that.
I just thought his eyes were so dead. There was nothing, like no remorse, no feeling, like just kind of a blank stare.
12 Anderson County jurors sentenced Sean Finnegan to death in August for the gruesome murder of Jennifer Paxton. Now, one of those 12 is sharing her story. She says seeing photos of Paxton's body was one of the hardest parts of the trial. The state said Paxton was severely tortured and suffered hundreds of injuries.
We had a juror cry. My hand went to my mouth. Like, it was terrible. That's probably what sticks with me the most.
The experience was emotional.
It's the hardest thing I've done. The mental stuff that we had to go through, just all of it, I would say I don't recommend it, and I wouldn't want to do it again.
But despite those hardships, she says justice was served.
We just hope that we were able to bring a little bit of peace to the family.
To me, at least, it is rare to get that opportunity to talk to a juror after the fact. How did this come to pass?
Well, I don't do it all the time, but in a case where I think it would be really interesting to hear from a juror, if they're willing,
right,
I'll make the request. So through somebody in the court system, I put the word out that we were interested if anyone was willing to talk. And it sometimes will work, especially if, I mean, when you're in court every day, they're seeing mm-hmm. Ellis, they're seeing me, and they're like, oh, I mean, they know what's going on
right.
outside of, you know, the evidence being presented. They see us, we see them. If a trial goes long enough, you do little things like nod your head, or you will look at jurors and they will look at you. So having essentially in a way established a kind of a silent relationship, mm-hmm. if you will, sometimes I think it's appropriate to reach out and see if anybody would be willing to talk about the experience and what they thought of the verdict. So that was a case where That woman was agreeable. We very much appreciate the fact that she took the time. I think she initially had some reservations. I think we tried to sort of give her some comfort into how it would work.
Yeah, to that point, as we saw in the story, we did not disclose her name or her face.
Right.
How did that decision-making come to pass?
Well, that was a big discussion between management and
us. Because that's not offered freely.
No, no, no. We don't do that, but... You know, keep in mind that jurors' identities are essentially secret through up through the process. Now, after a trial is over, there's a strong legal argument that it's no longer secret, although some judges will try and still make it secret. I think you could fight that, but usually, I mean, you know, jurors' names are, they've then become public. So she, because she lives in the community, she was concerned, and it was such an incredibly high-profile case, she wanted some protection, and we discussed it, and we're like, well, you know who you were, because we looked at you every day, and you know who we are, so we were okay with showing her essentially in the dark. And the other thing was we also had a male juror who thought about it, and then ultimately decided, I don't think I want to take part in the interview, but I believe he gave us a statement which we passed on to Jennifer's family because he wanted the family to sort of know his thoughts and share his sympathy with what they'd been through. But you don't ask for something like that all the time, but there are some instances where if a juror is willing to speak, it lends a fascinating aspect into the case.
Yeah, it gives you another layer of the story.
And hearing, you know, what that juror said, even about what the conversations were like in deliberations, some people having a little bit more reservation, okay, well, can we really sentence this man to death? We think he's responsible, we think he's guilty, but can we really sentence him to death if we don't know who took the final blow, so to speak, like I mentioned earlier. So it was interesting to kind of be brought in to that room and hear how they had to talk about it as a group. Everyone, of course, has to be on the same page and hear kind of about the different personalities on the jury, because that's something that otherwise we just would have no idea what their conversations are. We only know what the verdict is, of course.
It gives you a peek into that window.
She told us, and we learned that, I mean, they deliberated death over 2 days, essentially, starting on one day, going back to the hotel, and then starting again the following day, that she wondered if they would come to a vote for death. I don't think in her mind she had any doubt about how she felt about it, but she wondered about some of the other jurors. They go back to the hotel for the night to kind of chill, relax, come back, and then ultimately did decide, and there was some prayer involved, I think she mentioned. That unanimous that it should be death for Sean Finnegan.
And that was not the end of his appearances in court. He ended up after the fact, after being sentenced to death, going back into the courtroom where he faced child rape charges. Fill us in on that.
Well, I showed up. We went to that court appearance really expecting for there to be a trial. And then kind of at the last minute, and keep in mind, this is after he has already been sentenced to death. He is in prison for the rest of his living life until he faces the death penalty. We thought there was going to be a trial. And then really at the last second, he pleaded guilty. And so there wasn't a trial, but he did plead guilty to both of those charges.
And 45 years on top of.
And I think Dishman had been involved in that, too. They had been, like, babysitting the kids or something.
And these are young kids.
It happened in all of this time when Dishman was with him, and,
John, you have covered several cases that have ended with the death penalty. You have actually witnessed an execution. Do you ever see a time that Finnegan will be put to death, or do you think he'll spend his final days? I mean, there's really no way of knowing, but just from your experience in death cases, what are your thoughts?
Well, he's in his late 50s now, I think, right? He never appeared to be in great health. My guess would be he probably won't live long enough to see the execution itself.
The appeals process is extremely
long. That's lengthy. It's multi-layered. So you're probably looking at another 15 or 20 years of all of that, which I think my guess would be the odds are he's gone before he's taken to the execution chamber, because the state of Tennessee is still scheduling executions for murders that were committed in the 1990s.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we have a ways to go. We have fewer people sitting waiting to be executed in the state of Tennessee, but my hunch would still be he'll probably be dead before then. I'm sure Dishman will outlive him in prison.
Mm-hmm. Ellis, I've asked John this question many times because he's been on this podcast many times, but I want to ask you as a journalist, a young journalist, why is it important for us, even in such gruesome situations, to be in the courtroom, listening to the details? Why is it important for us to be doing this when it comes to our community?
I think there's a few different ways after covering this case that I look at that. I think growing close with Paxton's family, they really appreciated that we were there every single day, that we continued to cover it, that we went to court for the child rape charges, that we interviewed a juror and sent, you know, their well wishes back to the family. I think that's important for people to see, especially because they felt like, despite Paxton's drug history, of course she was still a person and deserved justice. And then I also think, you know, it's a gruesome case, but it's important for people to know that this does happen. It can happen in your backyard, unfortunately. You know, it's important for us to cover things like this and for people to know what's going on in their community and how our law enforcement is handling things like this.
And one thing of the many cases that we have delved into with Behind the Headline, what you do realize too over and over is so many of these people, their background, their past, plays a lot in their present and their future.
Mm-hmm. I guess I would just like to leave people with this thought. There are many Jennifer Paxtons out there in the world right now. They're in Knoxville, Tennessee. They're in other parts of East Tennessee. They're all over the world, and they're people that need help. And you should think about that. And if you know somebody like that, you should try to do something to help somebody like that, because they deserve that. They should be helped so that their lives can be better.
And I guess in this case, those neighbors, once they got wind of what had happened in that apartment, they let authorities know. So, Ellis, John, thank you both for stepping us through this very disturbing case. We appreciate both of you. You can watch past episodes of Behind the Headline streaming right now on WBIR Plus. You can also listen on Spotify and Apple. And that is our time. Thank you so much for watching, and we hope you'll join us the next time for Behind the Headline.